The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello! This is Cindy Fowler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Dave's Garden e-newsletter, the National Garden Association e-newsletter, the Triangle Gardener magazine, and maybe from Great Gardening Gizmos by Rodale, or 1001 Hints and Tips for Your Garden by Reader's Digest. We'll start with Dave's Garden website. This article is titled, Aunt Bet and Aunt Mint, Wild Mint, by Sharon Brown. I thought I knew all my relatives until I heard the grown-ups talking about Aunt Mint. They whispered when her name was mentioned, which only served to get my curiosity going full force. This is a story of whispers and sadness, and even today it makes me smile. This might be a skeleton in my closet. They thought I could not hear when they whispered, but I did. I heard every word they said, and learned much more by listening between the words. Aunt Mint was my maternal grandmother's younger sister, and I had never known her because she died well before I was born. I had seen her picture, though, so I knew what she looked like as a child. What I did not know was what had brought about her demise. If it had been left up to them, I would never have known. Sometimes I felt as if I were on one side of the fence and they were on the other. They being the grown-ups. What they didn't know is that I remembered everything and knew eventually I would have enough stored information to be able to link it all together, and then I would understand the whole picture. So I had a plan. I was going to listen to every whisper, and I was going to get to know the story about Aunt Mint and anybody else they whispered about. I was not very sickly as a child, but you would have thought I was dying with every sniffle. One time, I swear, Aunt Bet covered me from head to foot with some mint-smelling salve that brought tears to my eyes. Then she put that red flannel rag on my chest, and of course it stuck to the salve. Made me sweat, too, and she told me she was going to sweat that sniffle right out of me. And she did. Aunt Bet used mint in a lot of things, along with the salve. She also made a mint tea. She crumbled the dried young mint leaves into water, let it come to a boil, then when it was cool, gave it to me to drink. Finally, I told her I thought the mint tea would be better if she dropped a dab of honey in it while it was still hot, and maybe a little lemon if she had some, please. You would have thought I had become a Nobel Prize winner, she was so proud. Well, child, I think you might be learning some good things after all. I do believe you're right. The mint tea was served every time I had a tummy ache or a head cold, so after that day, she always gave it to me warm with honey and lemon. I'm not sure where she got the lemon, because citrus fruit was pretty scarce in the mountains in those days. At every opportunity in the summer, we gathered the leaves of the young mint that grew in the back of her garden. She would dry them for use in winter for colds and any time for tummy aches. She kept mint on hand. Trying to ease into a conversation about Aunt Mint was like trying to ease into the vault at Fort Knox. I would say, Aunt Bet, was Aunt Mint named after the mint plant? A nod, maybe, or maybe an uh-huh, which could mean anything. Aunt Bet, do you know what happened to Aunt Mint? I really would like to know. Don't be asking about things that don't pertain to you, little miss. When time's right, you'll be told whatever you need to know. I thought they'd never allow me to grow up, but Aunt Bet did tell me a lot about mint, the plant. Mintha was an old plant used for centuries, according to Aunt Bet, for upset stomachs and mild congestion from colds. Her Native American ancestors also used it for purification ceremonies, in which they drank enough to make them not only sweat, but eliminate impurities from their bodies. It was a potent diuretic, and still is, according to every herbal medicine source I've read. Another idea Aunt Bet had was the scent of mint helped clear one's mind so that with purified thoughts, people, especially students, would be open-minded to learning. She told me in olden days in some high-learning places, students would wear wreaths made of mint around their heads or necks so they could learn more. Today, when reading about mint, I found this in Wikipedia. In Rome, Pliny recommended students wear a wreath of mint, since it was thought to increase thinking and mind ability. I wonder now, just how on earth did Aunt Bet know that? Whenever we were out in the mountains or in Aunt Bet's garden, likely as not, she'd crunch a bunch of mint leaves and rub them all over my face, neck, and hands and arms to keep bugs from biting. I find myself doing the same thing today when my 5-year-old grandson comes to play with me in my garden. Now all that brings me back to Aunt Mint. I was nearly an adult when finally Aunt Bet told me the story. It seems Aunt Mint had married a good-for-nothing man, had 2 young sons by him. And back in those days, divorce was not an option, particularly in my family. One day, when the boys were very young, Aunt Mint had left them in the care of her sister, my grandmother. Aunt Mint walked into the town where she lived to get groceries, was walking home, following the path beside the railroad tracks. Her husband had been gone a month or two, and she didn't much care, since it was a lot easier on her and the boys when he was not at home. He returned that day, and in an inebriated state, he killed her. She died instantly. He ran away and was not found for several years. All the while Aunt Bet had been telling me this, I was shaking my head up and down. She looked at me straight in the eye and said, "You already know this story, don't you? Who told you, child?" "Aunt Bet," I said, "do you remember when I asked you to please add honey and lemon to my mint tea? Well, when you thought I was asleep beneath the cover of the red flannel, you and my Nina talked about Aunt Mint, and you told Nina that as smart as I was, I would be asking for alcohol in my mint tea next." Aunt Nina said, "Lordy, don't mention no alcohol in this family. Think about what that alcoholic done to Mint. No granddaughter of mine's ever going to touch no alcohol." Aunt Bet just shook her head and said, "You must have been wearing that mint around your neck if your memory is that good. Lordy, child, that was 10 years ago. What's going to become of you?" Well, no alcoholism found its way into my life, and I still have mint that I brought from Aunt Bet's garden to mine so many years ago I cannot remember. Maybe I should start wearing it around my neck again just to give my memory a jolt every now and then. Every time I pick a leaf of mint, I remember Aunt Bet, Granny Nina, and the Aunt Mint story. I guess the skeleton is for sure out of this closet. And now, from the National Gardening Association e-newsletter, Miniature Roses for the Holidays by Karen Dardick. Not so long ago, miniature roses were almost strictly the province of hobbyists, but now an entirely new category of miniature roses is available here. In fact, these are the type you are most likely to encounter at supermarkets, chain stores, and discount stores. While the two types look pretty much the same, it's useful to understand how florist minis compare to the miniature garden roses. Late fall is best to introduce yourself to florist minis. They're widely available, inexpensive, perfect for indoor holiday decorations. For the most part, miniature roses are scaled-down versions of full-sized roses and have small, rarely fragrant flowers. All can be traced back to the China rose. Plants range from 5 inches or less to 3 to 4 feet, even larger. Flowers can be 1/2 to 2 inches across, with a color range as broad as for the full-size roses. Mini roses are naturally outdoor tough plants. Given a good cover of snow or mulch, they'll survive winter as far north as zone 4. Dozens of mini roses grow in my sunny Los Angeles garden. I appreciate them for what they are, easy-to-grow perennials in almost constant bloom. I tuck them into borders, display them in containers, and cut sprays for miniature bouquets. Mini roses also adapt to life out indoors. Unlike many houseplants with a tolerance of low light and humidity, roses need plenty of bright light, such as in a bright west or south-facing window. For repeat bloom, you'll need supplementary light provided by fluorescent tubes. If light is insufficient, the plant's stems will stretch. You'll also have to provide some extra humidity around the plants. A water-filled tray with a layer of pebbles is usually sufficient. Again, the plants will tell you if humidity is low. Leaves will shrivel, yellow, and drop. In the garden, a significant advantage of mini roses compared to their larger brethren is easy care. Most are grown on their own roots and therefore tend to be hardier and easier to prune than larger grafted roses. The best time to prune is early summer after spring flowers fade. Again, late fall after fall flowers fade. Florist or garden minis, to make the best use of both, it's important to know the difference. All miniature roses have a common ancestor, but through hybridization and selection, very different plants have evolved. Consider the European types as florist plants and American types as garden. There's nothing European or American about either, but the popularity of the florist type is a European-led phenomenon. The primary hybridizer of florist roses is Poulsen Roser, APS, a rose company based in Denmark. Chris Pellet, representative for Poulsen Roser Pacific, explained that Poulsen's mini roses were bred for suitability for greenhouse culture, long shelf life, uniform flower color and growth. Proportionately larger flowers on the small plants, and durability for shipping. She added, gardeners should think of these pot plants as florist plants. Enjoy them inside while they bloom, then plant them out in the garden. In Europe, these plants are considered disposable. After the blooms fade, out they grow. Garden minis are much more diverse than the Poulsen. They're grown more slowly than florist minis, 5 months to a year compared to 3 months, and being better established, might have a better chance adapting to a new environment in your home. Typical garden minis have one rooted cutting to a 2.5-inch pot. The grandfather of the miniature rose business is Ralph Moore, founder of Sequoia Nursery in Visalia, California. Carolyn Suppinger of the nursery told me, "We always encourage our customers to enjoy their miniature roses outdoors, but we have people, especially in the East, who are successful if they use special growing lights and are vigilant about fighting spider mites. Inspect carefully before bringing indoors, especially important if you buy by mail order and intend to keep and grow the plants. Or if you have many other indoor plants you don't want to expose to new pests. Mini roses come in many kinds and sizes. For indoor growing, select varieties that grow no taller than 16 inches. Among the best are pink Baby Grand, orange Bambino, yellow-edged Scarlet Chasing Rainbows, white Cinderella, pink Cupcake, medium yellow Glory Bee, electric pink Live Wire, yellow with orange Rainbow's End, bright red Red Minimo, yellow Rise and Shine, red Santa Claus, shrimp pink Shelley Renee, deep red Sorcerer, salmon pink Spice Drop, and deep orange-red Starina. Veteran gardener Ann Hooper of Reading, Massachusetts, loves roses and filled her garden with more than 350 roses of all types, including at least 50 varieties of miniature roses. She enjoys holiday blooms by growing dozens of 6-inch pots indoors in a system featuring fluorescent lights. In her cellar, she set up a 2-tier growing table. Each tier has 4 4-foot fluorescent light tubes, 2 cool white and 2 warm white. She places pots in 6 to 8-inch deep trays under the lights. She recommends buy new plants each season to ensure your plants are free of disease and pest. Select varieties described as good for pot forcing or suitable for containers. Many miniature roses are suitable, but those that are shorter and especially floriferous perform better. When the 2-inch potted plants arrive, repot each one into a 6-inch container. Use a commercial potting mixture containing perlite and vermiculite. Water thoroughly and place under fluorescent lights in trays with pebbles and water in them. Never let the plants dry out completely. To reduce the chance of pest and disease, bathe each plant once a week under running water, washing the undersides of leaves as well as the top. Fertilize weekly with a fertilizer diluted to 1/4 strength. To encourage blooms, select a fertilizer with a formula high in potassium, such as 5-5-10. Watch carefully for any sign of pests. Spray white flies with a lightweight horticultural oil. If spider mites are a problem, wash thoroughly every 2 to 3 days. For a severe infestation, strip all leaves and cut the plant back by half. Healthy new growth will emerge rapidly. Buds should reappear about 6 weeks after repotting. When the buds start to open, bring the pot into the living area to enjoy. Flowers should stay attractive and healthy for 10 to 14 days. When flowering finishes, return plants to the light table and repeat the process for a second bloom cycle. Allow about 6 weeks for flowers to develop. After the last frost in your area, gradually acclimate plants to outdoor air. In spring, plant them in the garden or in an outdoor container. And now from the Triangle Gardener magazine, Consider Planting Heirloom Vegetables by Christine Thompson. Heirloom tomatoes have become popular products in farmers' markets and on restaurant menus. Their less than perfectly round shapes and varied colors make them easily recognizable. In addition, their hearty tastes elevate a simple tomato sandwich or a salad to new levels of delight. The succulence of these old-fashioned tomatoes piqued my interest in growing other heirloom vegetables. If, like me, you're curious about the varieties of heirloom plants available, I recommend reading Heirloom Vegetable Gardening by William Boyce Weaver before you plant next year's garden. This book provides a guide to planting, seed saving, and cultural history to many original American vegetables. Although Weaver is not well known as a garden writer, he is recognized as a culinary author who has won 4 Julia Child Cookbook Awards. His inclusion of historic recipes with some of the plants hints at this background, but this book primarily reflects his long fascination with heirloom vegetables. His own heirloom seeds are available through the Baker Creek Heirloom Seed website under the name Roughwood Seed Collection. In the first chapters of his book, Weaver explains the history of vegetable gardening and seed collection. Here he notes the U.S. has an unusually diverse mixture of heirloom seeds due to introductions from Native Americans and Afro-Americans, Asians, and European immigrants. Weaver notes seeds now considered heirlooms either survived the Civil War years or were developed during the following urban population migrations of the Industrial Revolution. This created farming for profit, which in turn produced a need for more vegetables. Only the most productive vegetable seeds were therefore retained. The vegetables Weaver identifies as best for the average gardener and small gardens are arranged in alphabetical order. Weaver introduces each type of vegetable with histories of the seed's source and often its multiple unusual names. In these discussions, Weaver includes each plant's hardiness zones, maturation time, plant size, and normal yield. If you are so inspired by the photographs in Weaver's book of gorgeous vegetables that you literally can't wait until spring to plant something, Countertop Gardens by Shelley Lewis will help by offering multiple options for indoor gardening. To assist new inside gardeners, she explains the difference in containers, growing mediums, seed versus transplants, fertilizers, and lighting requirements. Lewis recommends which herbs, vegetables, and garden greens will do best when planting indoors. As the manager of a garden store, Lewis is experienced in choosing products for all aspects of indoor gardening. She passes this information on to readers by listing her best choices of equipment and their sources. Also, DIY enthusiasts will enjoy a chapter devoted to building indoor gardening devices. For me, the prospect of growing small crops at any time is intriguing, but planting heirloom vegetables such as lazy wife bean, cheese pumpkin, or elephant nose pepper will definitely add a fun diversity to my garden. And from 1001 Hanson Tips for Your Garden by Reader's Digest, ornamental vegetables, favorites for fall. Gourds are one of the most popular vegetables grown for their decorative value. Harvest these cucumber cousins in autumn for their bright colored shells in yellow, orange, and green, and their odd shapes from turbans to penguins. The handsome artichoke. The silver-gray serrated leaves of the artichoke contrast well with flowering bedding plants. You can grow it for the value of its foliage alone, without regard to its climate needs. Autumn accents, with their ruffled foliage veined in rose, pink, purple, or cream white, ornamental cabbage and kale are cold-hardy specimens that will adorn the garden well into winter. Plant them after summer flowers fade, along paths or in borders or tubs, for extra color. Team them with fall bloomers like chrysanthemums, asters, and October daphne. Good choices include eye-catching Dynasty Pink cabbage and Cherry Gâteau kale. Homegrown bowls. Cut away the centers of ornamental cabbage and kale to make serving bowls for salads or dips. You can also peel off the outer leaves and arrange them as a liner on a serving plate. Colorful corn. Grow ornamental corn for its prettily patterned kernels, ideal in autumn displays. Try rainbow Inca for red, blue, and orange kernels, or oxycon green for emerald ones. Strawberry popcorn produces berry-shaped ears with tiny red kernels. Also, try red stalker corn for its red-purple stalks. Good eating, good looking. Many common vegetables are attractive enough to be used as ornamental. Use tequila sunrise or chocolate bell peppers, and violet queen cauliflower for their fruits. For textured or colorful leaves, plant ruby chard, savoy cabbages, or red sale lettuce. Mistletoe. Christmas wouldn't be complete without this native plant, a traditional green used in kissing balls and other decorations. But mistletoe is an invasive parasite that sucks the sap from its host tree, causing weakness or death. To get rid of it, pull or cut it out, removing all roots. Do it early. The smaller the plant, the easier the removal. Be cautious. Mistletoe stems, leaves, and berries are all poisonous and should be considered dangerous. If you use the plant in holiday decorations, keep it away from children by hanging it from a doorway or ceiling. To grow mistletoe, start by selecting a host tree that is at least 20 years old. Collect ripe white berries from mistletoe that is already growing on another tree of the same variety as your host. Find a branch on the host that is 5 feet off the ground and about 6 inches in diameter. Smash the berries against the branch's underside. The sticky pulp will harden and help seeds adhere to the bark. After seeds have germinated, they will sprout and eventually invade the host. Attack of the gypsy moths. In 1868, a professor returned to America from France, clutching a package. Inside were a handful of gypsy moth caterpillars in a cage, raw materials for the professor's dream of breeding a hybrid to make silk. Soon thereafter, wind blew open the cage. The caterpillars escaped. Within a decade, they were chomping a swath through oaks, apples, birch, and other favorite hosts, infesting millions of acres. The larvae are so destructive, they can defoliate a tree in 2 weeks. Numerous attempts have been made since the early 1900s to eradicate gypsy moths with everything from DDT to beneficial insects, but they remain a serious pest. You can often spot their brown egg clusters on tree bark or see and hear the caterpillars, which are spotted blue and red, feeding in early summer. Adults emerge in July. Males are brown and females white. Larvae can be controlled with burlap barriers wrapped around tree trunks or by spraying BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, every 14 days from April to June. Egg masses can be straked into a pail of kerosene. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Cindy Fowler, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long, until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.